Today's Teisho will be on case 28 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 28, what the Holy Ones have not preached. Main subject, Nansen went to see Hyakujo Nehan Osho. Hyakujo said, is there any Dharma that the Holy Ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. Joe said, you have just preached. Nansen said, I am like this, how about you? Joe said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there is preaching or no preaching? Nansen said, I don't follow you. Joe said, I have talked quite enough. Secho's verse, patriarchs and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging. Looking southward, see the great bear. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth. Thank everybody for getting up early this morning and coming here to practice Zen. I have been doing this for 35 years, since I was 22 years old. And I got up this morning and I drove here. It was cold. It was 26 degrees this morning. I drove in the car and beautiful morning, listened to the radio, to my favorite radio show, Living on Earth. And I got here and I noticed there was a policeman skulking over in the shadows. I thought he was up to no good, probably. But then I parked my car and I came in to here and turned on the lights. And I had all kinds of baggage left over from the week, you know. This was a busy week for me. Problems, the usual stuff, you know. And then at 7 o'clock we recited the sutras, and then we had a tea, a delicious tea, and then a bathroom break, and then we sat down and started sitting. And we've just gotten up a little while ago, another bathroom break, and beautiful walking meditation. And as we were walking, I felt so good. I felt so good. I felt like every atom of my body had been scrubbed clean, you know. I'm not boasting or something like that. That's just how it is if you practice for a while. You know, you might come here and you might feel very tense, very stressful. Maybe you have a lot of tension in the back of your neck. Maybe you have you're clenching your jaws, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe there's just like fear behind your consciousness. There's something making you nervous, you know, right behind your awareness. And, you know, even though sitting can be physically challenging, you know, it can be quite difficult to sit still for such a long period of time. Your knees may hurt, your back may hurt. I think when you will find that when you get up, you feel really wonderful sometimes, really clean and clear. There's something very special about this kind of practice, you know. This sustained sitting. I think I've mentioned this before, but when my second teacher went to China, he went to a temple, and above the doors of the temple it said, deep sitting makes people not crude-spirited. And crude-spirited is angry, fearful, envious, and so on, you know. And not crude-spirited is serene, generous, compassionate, loving, awake, attentive, and so on. So this kind of sustained sitting is really very, very precious, really wonderful. And very, very pure. You know, not everybody can do Zazen. You know, Zazen is really a challenging practice. We don't have a mantras to recite. We don't do visualizations. We don't have prayers that we recite on the cushion. You know, you watch your breath until you can enter emptiness. And then you bring your mind back to the present moment. And that's it. That's the method. But it's quite extraordinary what it can accomplish. You know? It's not for everybody because some people have a very difficult time with this kind of directness. But if it works for you, it can be like the road to paradise, this really marvelous practice. So today's Taisho is about an encounter between two Zen masters. One is a very famous Zen master named Nan Chuan. Nan Sen was the teacher of Joshu. So Joshu and Nan Sen were friends for many decades. And this is a story about Nansen, probably before he met Joshu, or before Joshu became his student. But Nansen was traveling around China, and he went to a temple where he met a monk, a Zen master named Hyakujo Nehan Osho. This is not the other Hyakujo that we know, Hyakujo's fox. This is a different Hyakujo. And they had what is called, unfortunately or fortunately, a dharma combat, dharma exchange. But basically, both teachers were trying to gauge the level of awareness of the other teacher. And they were doing this by basically throwing up an obstacle and seeing if the other person became trapped by it. Now, you know, we all get trapped all the time by things. You know, we get trapped all the time. So, the other day, I met a friend of mine whom I haven't seen in many years. He's from the University of Pittsburgh, and he's a rather well-known person in the field that I work in. And he came to visit Rutgers and give a talk. And I have known him for 25 years. And I went up to see him. His name is Dave. And I said, you know, I had to teach in the afternoon, but his talk was at 4:30, so I went over to the library where he was giving his talk. And I saw him, and I instantly recognized him, even though I haven't probably seen him in 8 years. And I went up and I said, "Dave, you look great." And he said, "You look pretty good too." And I thought he was supposed to say, "You look great too." I think I had said something like, "You look great, you don't look a day older." And he said, "Well, you look pretty good too." So I guess I look a day older. So for a minute, that arrested me, right? It made me stop and think, well, wait a minute, you know, am I really that much older? Do I really look old, et cetera, et cetera? This is like stopping the mind, right? Something caused me not to be as open and expansive as I could have been, right? If I had been maybe just sitting on a cushion and I had gotten up and my mind was very clear and bright and open, somebody said that, I would have just laughed, you know. But at the time, it had resonance for me. It sort of stopped my mind. It made me withdraw a little bit from the world, you know? I had been thinking, I guess, about getting older a lot this week. I read something in a newspaper about one of my favorite rock musicians named Peter Townshend, who from The Who. And he wrote Tommy, if you've ever heard, some of you have probably heard of The Who. But in my day, they were really big. They were one of the biggest groups. And they produced the rock opera Tommy and other really amazing music. I think Peter Townsend is a really great composer, and I love The Who's music. And when I was 17, my brother and I had all the Who's records, and I remember one of the records had a picture of Peter Townsend on the back, and he was at that time. He was probably about 4 years older than I was, maybe 5 years older, and he was very thin, had black hair, and he had a face that was very soft and gentle. Probably no beard yet, you know, because he was very young, and he would have been a very attractive girl, as a matter of fact. Now he's 60-some years old. He's probably a little older than 4 years older. Maybe he's in his mid to late 60s. And he has no hair on his head. He's totally bald. His face is, very puffy. You know, he's a 67-year-old man. If you put the two pictures side by side, you couldn't recognize him. And I was, before I went to meet my friend Dave, I was already thinking about getting older. And I looked at this picture of Peter Townsend in 1967 and this picture of him now. And it just hit me, you know, I'm getting older too. And this is not necessarily a good thing, you know. And I thought, you know, when I was young, when I started studying Buddhism when I was 22 years old, I used to remember hearing the Buddha say, everybody is subject to sickness, old age, and death. And I was 22 and I was in very good health. So I knew sickness, no. You know, death, no, still alive. Right. Old age, not going to happen to me. Right. So sickness, old age, and death were very abstract. But suddenly when I was looking at Peter Townsend's face in 1967 and his face now, I realized, oh, you know, in some ways, getting older is almost like a disaster, right? You know, it's like, oh my God, what happened to this guy? You know? Well, he got older. Charles de Gaulle, the president of France, when he was quite old, they asked him about old age, and he said, old age is like a shipwreck. He said, it's like a shipwreck. You know? So I guess I was thinking all of this, and it was in the back of my mind when I went to see my friend David. And I went up to him, and he does indeed look not a day older than he did 10 years ago. And I said, David, you look fantastic. And he said, oh, you look pretty good too. And then I thought, oh, Why don't you say I look fantastic? And my mind was stopped. See? Stopped. If you are painter, you know, you paint a beautiful painting, and somebody goes up to it and goes, that's interesting. You want them to go up and go, oh, that's fantastic. There's a wonderful movie about Jackson Pollock starring Ed Harris. And he's incredibly dedicated to his art. The movie makes it clear that he would get up every day, like a person with a regular job, and he had a little shed near his house where he would paint. And his wife would make him a little lunch, and he'd put it in a lunch bucket, and he'd go out to his studio, and he'd spend the day out there, just like a regular job. And he painted like all day long, you know, just pushed and pushed and pushed. So there's a scene in the movie where he's got this painting that he's done, and he's brought it in the house, and he has all his friends from New York, including this very famous art critic named Clement Greenberg. And Clement looks at the painting, and Jackson Pollock is so hungry for his approval. He wants him to say, that is a fantastic painting. But Greenberg doesn't say that. He hangs back, you know, and he says something which is like not very complimentary, not negative, but it sets Pollock on edge. He realizes that Greenberg doesn't like the painting. And then he gets very down. At one point he gets drunk and he's almost going to cut the painting with a knife. You know, that means his mind has been stopped. You know, ordinarily, we get stopped very easily. You know, something happens and we withdraw. It's like you're in the moment, but you don't want to be there, you know, and you withdraw into yourself. You withdraw. You become frozen, or you become stopped. Now, this is like samsara. This is samsara, right? You withdraw from the world around you, and you find yourself becoming more isolated because you're hurt, or you're trying to be protected from what's around you. And this is in Zen ways of thinking. This is like you've been stopped. Now, we're not always stopped. You know, sometimes things can be very different from that. You know, so for example, maybe you decide you're going to ride your bicycle. You know, maybe after the sit today, you're going to ride your bicycle with some friends. And you go over to see your friends, and basically they've made you a little lunch, the delicious lunch. You say, "Gee, thank you." You know, and you have lunch, and then you all get on your bike, and it turns out to be a sunny day. It warms up. You know, maybe a girl you're interested in or a boy you're interested in comes on the trip, and you say things, and they find you clever and witty, you know. You know, maybe you ride for 10 miles, and you stop, and you have a cup of coffee somewhere, and then you ride more. And as things are unfolding, it just seems to be naturally blossoming. It's like the moment is just unfolding naturally, and you can trust it. And the universe seems to be going your way. You know, it seems to be opening up without anything interfering. And if things are going well, you sort of give yourself to the moment. You give yourself to the process, you know? And so, you know, you're open and you're giving yourself to the unfolding of events, see. Now, this is a highly desirable state. This is like, we call this in Zen the trusting mind, This is the mind that doesn't separate itself from the world. It every moment is reaching out into the world, is going out into the world in a spirit of trust, and as things unfold, you're unfolding with them. See? So these are like the two poles. One pole is like samsara, which is where, you know, you're stopped and you withdraw from the world and you go into yourself, right? And now you're frozen in your isolation. And of course that just makes your fear and anxiety worse. So, you know, being stopped is something that happens to us all the time. But every once in a while, we're not stopped. We flow. You know, we're in the Tao as it's unfolding, and we give ourselves to the world. You know, it's giving yourself to the world, right? You know, and life is sort of like sometimes we're stopped and sometimes we're not stopped. If you do something like, you know, when I was a kid, I used to play baseball. I was a really terrible baseball player. But every once in a while, there'd be a game that was really, things went really well, you know. I'm not very coordinated, at that time, I was not very strong. And, you know, but every once in a while, when I would play ball, it would seem like everything was right, you know. I'd throw the ball, and it would actually make it all the way into the guy's glove, you know, which was unusual for me. and I'd throw it and it would actually go in the right place, you know, or somebody would hit the ball and I would actually catch it, which was quite unusual for me, you know. And, you know, every once in a while there'd be a game where it was just like, almost like magic, you know, like I could do no wrong, you know. Everything, it was like, wow, this is, you know, this is so... And when things are like that, we trust and we open up and we sort of give ourselves to things as they're happening, see. So this is like samsara and the other is nirvana, you know. Nirvana is like when we're in the flow, in the flow of things, and we're trusting, see. So sometimes when two Zen teachers meet, you know, they'll try to assess each other's degree of awakenedness by trying to arrest the other person and seeing if they can still flow. Seeing if they can still flow. About 16 years ago? Yeah, about 16 years ago, I went up to study, practice Zen with a teacher who was the Dharma brother of my first teacher. This man had a temple in the Catskills. And I went up to see him. And I wanted to practice Zazen with him. Because he had a good reputation and I thought I could learn something from him. So I didn't introduce myself formally. I just signed up for the Sesshin and I went to the Sesshin. And when I went into Dokusan, I introduced myself to the teacher, and I said, I am a student of Takabayashi Genki Roshi and Kangan Glenn Webb. The teacher, even though he knew both of these people, he made a disparaging remark about my second teacher, Webb. It was like, you know, do you call him a Roshi? Something like that. And he was deliberately trying to insult me or provoke me to see how I would react, to see if I lost the flow, if I withdrew into myself or not. And if I had gotten really upset and said, how dare you talk about my teacher that way, you know, he studied at Myoshinji. He's a, you know, he's received Dharma transmission from, you know, Soko Morinaga, you know, how dare you, you know, then I would have been arrested, right? That would have been arrested. And instead I just smiled, which was which means I was arrested, but I didn't want him to know it. Yeah. I smiled wisely, like I was okay with that, right? And then I went back to the cushion and thought, how dare you insult my teacher? But he was doing something that Zen teachers have done to people for thousands of years, for better or for worse. He was testing me out to see if I would be arrested. So this is what so-called Dharma combat is all about. When you read about it in stories of Zen masters, it's really about whether I can do something that will make you close up or not. And, you know, a great Zen teacher, if you hear the words, a great Zen master, is not somebody who can sit in a full lotus for hours on end. A great Zen master is not somebody who goes around with gleaming eyes, you know, or, you know, and not somebody who can fly or something like that. A great Zen master is somebody who can stay open even when things are difficult. See? I have told a story more times than people care to hear, I'm sure, but some people are new here, so please forgive me for telling the story again. But, you know, many years ago, I was the attendant to Genki Roshi, my first teacher. And that meant that I had to go over to Kugeon quite a bit and sort of make sure he was in good shape and run errands for him and so on. And One time he had invited a monk from Japan, a Zen teacher from Japan, who was dying of cancer. And this guy had cancer, you know, and he was terminally ill. You know, and that means that sometimes he got up late, you know, sometimes he was not doing so well. But when I would encounter him, there was just this incredible life and real joy. And I don't think it was phony because, you know, why would he want to impress me? You know, I was just one little twerp, you know, and we were by ourselves in most of the time. You know, he could have just been naturally unhappy if that's the way he was. And instead, he was just incredibly... Sometimes I would look at his face and it was just like glowing. And I was quite convinced that this... You know, why would he pretend, you know? He had this wonderful openness to life even though he was dying, you know, which is, I think, this great accomplishment. You know, that I met a great Zen master. And it was this guy, you know. And he couldn't fly, and he didn't have a mysterious look, you know. And by the way, I don't think he's very well known. I don't think any, you know, he's not in the histories of Zen in America and so on and so on. But he was a great Zen master, somebody really accomplished. This is a moment where these two teachers are encountering each other, and they're trying to stop one another, trying to throw down something that's going to make the other stop and withdraw into himself. And they keep throwing things down, and neither one of them is really getting stopped, you know. So they're sort of like both very, very open people. That's the story of the koan. That's the koan, basically. You know, this idea of not getting stopped might be a little bit sound a little bit strange if you've read books on Buddhism, because, you know, when we think about enlightenment, you know, we often think of it as like being above it all or being apart from it all, you know. So, you know, when we think about, like, great Zen masters, we think of people who live in remote places in the mountains, for example, and might, you know, see no one for many days on end, and they're just sitting. And the world of Zen is filled with stories of such people. So, for example, the man who brought Zen to China from India was a South Indian monk named Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma came to China, and he sat in a cave by himself for 9 years. And the history of Zen is filled with these people who are recluses, and they live in the mountains, and they practice by themselves. And when you think about meditation practice in a certain way, it also has this character of withdrawing from the world, right? So, you know, in order to practice Zen, you have to, you know, basically turn off the TV and the radio and get away from your computer. It would be good if you couldn't hear the computer, you know, if you get out of that room, or you actually turn the computer off, that would be good. You sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and pretty soon your awareness of everything around you begins to disappear, right? It begins to become the awareness of things around you becomes very peripheral, you know? And you focus on your breath, and you gradually undergo a kind of change, you know? It's like if you meditate regularly and you do it just for like a half a year or something, you begin to notice that when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you begin to enter a kind of alternate consciousness. It's like you're just not processing anymore in the same way you ordinarily do. To me, it feels like when I was a kid on the base where I spent much of my life, I used to love to jump off the deep end and go down into the water. We had a diving pool that was maybe 18 feet deep. And if you jump into the water and you go down, as you go down, the water pressure becomes greater, I think. And you could feel the pressure enclosing you, you know. When I'm in this state of concentration, when I sit down on the cushion, I often feel like I'm down there at the bottom of the diving pool. You know, it's like I can feel like a kind of pressure. This is just how I experience that state. Everybody experiences it in a different way. But when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you enter this alternate consciousness. And the surroundings become much less present. Especially if you close your eyes, and if you focus on your breath, you begin to develop a kind of one-pointed mind that makes everything else but the breath incidental or even disappear from consciousness. So you watch the first breath, you watch the second breath, you watch the third breath, and little by little, it's like your focus contracts down to a pinpoint. You know, where you're just focusing on the breath. And, you know, if somebody knocks on your door or something, it can be very irritating. It's like, God damn it, you know, I'm trying to meditate. You know? So you might have to get up and, yes, what is it? You know, would you sign this? Yes, thank you, you know, have a nice day. Back to the cushion, you know, you sit down. Then you start zeroing in again, you know, and you zero in and everything disappears except for this little focus on the breath, you know, and then, you know, eventually, even the breath disappears. And you might be practicing Mu meditation, where you're focusing on absolutely nothing, on these blank spaces between the moments where you're taking in regular perception, you know. And so now you're in this void, really, this very blank place. And you're 100% focused on it sometimes. Sometimes you're in your head. And, you know, the awareness of everything else it goes away. And in this state, by the way, you can feel very blissful. You know, when you're in a deep samadhi state, you can feel very blissful, very joyous, you know. It's possible to come to the conclusion that Zen is really about withdrawing from the world. There's much in Zen tradition, in Buddhist tradition generally, that would lead you to think so, you know. So the Buddha, for example, was supposed to be a prince, you know. Probably he was a son of a tribal chieftain, actually. And because the Shakya Republic didn't really have an aristocracy, it had like these clans. Like big family units, and there was a head of each family. So, the head of the Buddha's family was his father, and there was probably like an extended network, family network. But anyway, the Buddha, you know, was supposed to be a prince, and he was supposed to be very wealthy, and he had everything he wanted, and. And he gave it all up. You know, he experienced sickness, old age, and death. And then he left the palace, and he left his beautiful wife and his beautiful child. And he went and meditated with the forest-dwelling rishis in North India. And the Buddha basically renounced, you know, the home. He was called a home leaver. And basically, Buddhist monks in Buddhist tradition are supposed to be home leavers, anagarika, without a home. And so, you know, Buddha gave up family, he gave up wife and child, he gave up career, and he became an anagarika, a homeless person, and he lived in the forest with the rishis. So, you know, it's possible to think about Buddhism in terms of renunciation, you know. Buddha never went back home. Even after his enlightenment, he didn't go home. His son eventually became a monk and had no children, and that was the end of that lineage. And his wife, Buddha's wife, eventually became a nun. So the whole family went into a monastic setting, and that was the end of that particular family. So you could think, okay, well, Buddhism is about withdrawing from the world. You know, we withdraw from the world on the cushion. And, you know, to practice Zen, you have to withdraw. You know, if you came here this morning, you probably had to say no to something else. You know, I do a lot of meditation. I sit four times at night in a formal setting. People, you know, want to invite me out to dinner. You want to go out to dinner? I say, well, actually, I have to go do Zazen with the Zen group. And I get up in the morning and I do Zazen, and I do Zazen on my own at night. And, you know, I could watch Mad Men on TV, but I go upstairs and I do Zazen. And I could, you know, go on a weekend bike trip, but I come here. So you could say, Zen is about renunciation. You know, and there is some truth to this. Buddhism is about saying no. You have to say no. You have to, goodbye, I'm going to meditate, close the door, leave me alone. I'm going to sit on my cushion, you know, turn off the phone, you know, turn off the computer, and just sit here. Okay, so there is an element of, like, renunciation. And also, you know, we have to withdraw psychologically. You know, meditation really does have a strong element of withdrawing, you know, into the self, or into mu, I should say. So, you know, Zen really, you really do close the door, turn off the TV, turn off the computer, sit down, you don't read, you don't talk to anybody, you focus on your breath, and then you enter mu shin. And you really do withdraw. You know, when you're in deep mu shin, deep emptiness, everything in the world can really disappear. It's really true. Everything. And that is a wonderful state and very liberating. And that emptiness is extremely liberating. You know, so being able to say no, walk away, close the door, you know, there is a kind of withdrawal, a kind of world renouncing, home leaving, involved in meditation practice in the Buddhist tradition. And in mu shin, everything really does disappear. And this state is really quite liberating. Why is it liberating? You know, we get trapped in our preferences, you know. We grow up and we develop habits, you know, habits. And they make us easily arrested by things, you know. So all human beings are going to get old. It's just a fact. There's nothing wrong with getting old. Everybody gets old. It's going to happen to all of us. And there's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's absolutely perfectly okay. But, you know, in a society like ours, where so much emphasis is put on being young, to be old is difficult, you know. I have a friend of mine his name is Harvey. And Harvey is about maybe 15 years older than I am. And he was telling me that he feels invisible. He's quite a bit older than I am, maybe more than 15 years. But he says that he goes into places and he feels like he's invisible. It's like people won't look at him because he's old. And he says, you know, I feel it's invisibility. He was telling me, he said, I remember the day, one day he realized that when he would walk into a room, no women would look at him anymore. See, you know, people are people, you know. When you're a young man, whether you're married or not, you walk in a room, if a woman looks at you, you think, ah, somebody looked at me. I'm worth looking at, you know. That's nice. It feels nice. It's nice to be lusted after, I guess you could say. So at some point in your life, you walk into a room and it's like you're just like a piece of meat, right? Like just an old man, right? So nobody's looking, oh. They might say, what a cute old man, you know. But it's not the same thing as what a sexy guy, right? What a cute old man. Or or they don't ask you how. There's a song that says they stop. They used to ask you how things are. Now they ask you how things were. Right? That's sad. So you know, we have a cultural image of youth is very good, young, sexy, young, old, very bad. See, so if you're getting old, it means you're getting very bad. So you sit down on the cushion and you think, oh, damn it, you know, I'm old, I'm getting older. You sit down on the cushion and you enter deep mushin, and then the most wonderful thing happens, right? Because suddenly, you know, you hear the fan, you go walk, we do our zazen and we go down into the hallway, and suddenly you feel like you're deathless, you know, energy, life energy, you know. And instead of withdrawing from the world, there's this going out into the world, you know. So I mean, I hope I'm making some sense, but you need to get to like that zero place, that absolute emptiness. And it wipes away like the cultural messages. It wipes away our traumas and so on. And all of a sudden you can experience the world in this fresh new way. You know? And so going to that empty place is essential. But once you go there, you know, you find it depends on what happens to you. You know, if you're really down in the dumps and you're really feeling defeated, you know, maybe one meditation period isn't going to do it. You know, it may take months of meditation, but sooner or later you enter that emptiness and you just feel, oh, I am so glad to be alive. You know, I am so glad to be here. It's so precious to be here. And you feel this life energy, sort of like deathless life energy and joy, see. And now you can go in the flow. Now you can flow with events. You know, you're okay, I'm old, it's okay. You know, it's actually great, you know. So I mean, this is what Zen is all about. There is an element of withdrawing from the world, we're a home leaving. No home leaving, no enlightenment. That's a fact. If you don't withdraw into mushin, you know, no enlightenment. So you know, there's a koan that says, what is Buddha? Everyday mind is Buddha. That doesn't mean you can smoke cigarettes and have a drink and watch Mad Men and so on, and you're going to just stumble into enlightenment. You have to come and sit. You have to do lots of zazen and so on. So there is a dimension of world renunciation in the path. But it's not the goal. The goal is a world embracing. So world renunciation is the means, and world embracing is the goal. See. And we all need a little world renunciation because we get so trapped in our cultural messages and in our personal bullshit, you know. We all get trapped in our own likes and dislikes and our own fantasies and dreams and disappointments. And then life becomes stale and empty, or we can't trust enough to give ourselves to the process. But when we go to that zero place, you know, if we really go there wholeheartedly, it really wipes away a lot of that stuff. And then when we come back into the world, we can embrace it with that wonderful trust, that wonderful wonderful trusting heart, trusting mind. See? So, this koan is really about not being arrested, not being frozen, not withdrawing from the world, but trusting the process. You know, as I said, a great Zen master is somebody who is not stopped, but keeps unfolding with the world in an open-hearted way, in a generous, kindly way. And that's what real, quote-unquote, spiritual greatness is all about. It's that ability to give oneself unconditionally to the world and to recognize the world as a self, as a true self. You know, and that's difficult. You know, that's harder than becoming a millionaire. It's harder than becoming a Nobel Prize winner. You know, but I think people who are, there are people who have this great spirit. You know, even if you didn't start with it, if you do a lot of Zen, you can develop like a greater spirit, greater openness. You know, years ago, many years ago, when I was out of college, I had a job working for the Mayflower Moving Company. I've had quite a few jobs in my life, and many of them have been difficult jobs that didn't pay a lot, and that were very hard work physically. And I worked for the Mayflower Moving Company, and I loved that job. It was just a fantastic job because you had to get up really early in the morning and go and move furniture. And I actually enjoy physical labor. And then you'd put everything in a moving truck and you might drive to another state and unload it. And I got to see, you know, when you're on the road, we would get to eat for free. You know, the company would pick up the tab so I could eat anything I wanted. And sometimes we'd sleep in a hotel, you know, and it was sort of an adventure. And sometimes we'd go to beautiful places, you know, and unload the furniture. But one of the jobs was I got called to a house where a bunch of a shipment of crates had been delivered. And basically the man who was living in this house out in the country had been a famous artist, and he had gone overseas. He had gone, among other places, he had gone to an ashram in India and lived for many years. And he had been a very famous artist when he left, and he had painted a bunch of paintings, big oil paintings, and he stored them in these crates and put them in a storage facility in Washington, D.C., and this was his retirement. This was his retirement policy. He was going to pull these paintings out one by one and sell them and live off the income from his paintings. So basically, when I met him, he was in a bed and he was probably like months away from death. He was very pale and sick. Maybe he had cancer or something. It was probably like that. And the bed was looking out the window at these fields, and it's a sort of a hilly country outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. And the bed was legs of the bed had been put on piles of books so the bed could be elevated so he could see out the window. I had a chance to walk by his bookcase, and it was full of books on Buddhism and Vedanta and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I went into the room where the crates were, and they were ruined. They were ruined. They had been, water had gotten into the storage facility. And our job was to take the lid off the crates and pull out these big oil paintings. But often the water had seeped in and caused the canvas to rot, and the paintings had fused together. You know, they were piled on top of each other in a correct way with a piece of paper between them, but it had all gotten fused together. We had to take a heat gun and separate these paintings. And the man's wife was just like, she just couldn't stop crying. It was devastating for her. And she was just, it was eating her alive. But I got to see the old man, and he was sitting in his bed, and I looked at him, and he was so serene. His face was so beautiful. You know, maybe he was just out of it. But I don't think so. He seemed very present and very intelligent, you know. And I think that he had accomplished something in that ashram. I think he had developed this great trust. You know, he was about to die, you know, and his life was in shambles. You know, among other things, this was his life's work, you know. Down the tubes, you know. Most people would be pretty miserable. I think I would be. But he was you know, his face was glowing. That's what we're shooting for in meditation practice, you know. That's our goal, to be like that in each of us in our own way. Case 28, what the holy ones have not preached. Main subject. Nansen came to see Hyakujo Nehan Osho. Joe said, is there any dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, yes, there is. Joe said, what is the dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. Joe said, you have just preached. Nansen said, I'm like this. How about you? Joe said, I'm not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there's preaching or no preaching? Nansen said, I don't know what you're talking about. Joe said, we both talk too much. Secho's verse. Founders, ancestors, and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging, looking southward the great bear. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth.